Good
morning, Your Honor. How are you today, sir?
I'm well, thank you. Do you want any time in rebuttal?
5 minutes, please, sir.
Okay, you have that. You may proceed when you...
Thank you very much. May it please the court, my name is James Broccoletti, and I'm here to represent Mr. Miller on an appeal from a decision from the Circuit Court of the City of Virginia Beach, which convicted him of aggravated malicious wounding as well as the hit and run of another vehicle in excess of $1,000. I think the two central focus and the two central questions that I present to the court, I know that the brief addresses three, but with the court's permission, without waiving, I'd address two primary focuses, which is how did this accident happen and what evidence did the Commonwealth present which allowed the trial court to rely upon that determined that the defendant was the perpetrator?
So we would, if I can, I think I'm hearing where you're going, is there sufficient evidence from a reasonable fact finder could conclude that your client struck the motorcyclist after the little argument?
Could not have said it any better.
Okay, but that's where we are in this
case. It is. That's point one.
Okay.
And then point two is the alcohol issue in terms of the admission of that.
And that's the victim's BAC.
Correct. So with respect to point one, as the trial court candidly conceded, there was absolutely no witness that saw how the accident itself happened. The trial court's decision was based upon, in his own words, circumstantial evidence, and he said, what else am I to conclude? Well, I'd suggest to the court that that's not the standard. What else is he to conclude to determine that the defendant actually struck this other motorcycle? It's not a circumstance, it's not a case in which the courts have held such in a child abuse case or in a child neglect case in which there's only one adult in the house and only one caretaker in the house, and there's only one person that could have committed that particular act. In those circumstances, the court has found that the evidence can be sufficient and the circumstantial evidence to be sufficient to conclude that that's the only individual that could be responsible. Here you have a multitude of explanations because you have the driver of a motorcycle involved in this accident that's not seen. You have, according to some of the witnesses, Ms. Torres specifically, on page 54 of the appendix, she talks about 10 cars being behind the two motorcycles at the time that the vehicles leave that particular scene. Now, I concede the defendant's actions ahead of time were inappropriate. And that's probably a kind word to use. That his words were inappropriate. That his driving was erratic. I concede all of those. There's no question
about
that.
But he seemed to have a... I mean, based on the exchange, he was angry at these two specific bikers, right?
One biker. He was not... There was no indication that he was angry with the victim. It was with the second person, Mr. Donaldson.
Right.
And he almost hit him and then went down.
According to Mr. Donaldson, that's correct.
Right. I mean, the testimony was
correct.
That.
Yes.
So why couldn't the fact finder extrapolate from his manifested anger, his behavior towards the other biker, that the reason for the accident was him deliberately trying to run this other motorcyclist off the road?
I think that you can go in that direction and begin the analysis, but again, without the dots being connected, that is that somebody has witnessed the actual striking of the car to the motorcycle, and there being such a gap in time, such a gap in space, so many other vehicles that are on the roadway. According to Mr. Donaldson, what he saw was that, this is on page 63, line 16 of the appendix, he saw the defendant hit an embankment. There then was a cloud of dust, and then when the dust settled, the bike was down. So we have the defendant striking some object or obstacle, if you will, even before the bike goes down. So I'd suggest to the court that that chain of events that the trial court tried to rely on.
Did the record reflect, and it helped me because I don't remember, that there was there any debris in the roadway that would have suggested that a pothole or something else?
No.
It's just the plain highway.
Just the highway. Just a
cloud of smoke hitting the embankment.
Sir?
Cloud of dust.
Dust. Correct.
Then the embankment.
Well, the embankment first, then the cloud of dust, then the bike is down. So the argument that I'm making to the court, especially to Judge McCullough, is that with respect to this chain of events that the trial court would have extrapolated from, this intervening cause of hitting the embankment certainly lends some doubt as to the fact that then the defendant's car then struck the motorcycle.
Would he have to strike the motorcycle, or could he just come at him and cause him to lose control? And
I think he has to strike the motorcycle. That's what the trial court found, that he struck the motorcycle. If we're dealing with that his actions then caused the bike to go down, that would be a different issue that was never presented, never argued, and the trial court never relied upon that. So with the conduct of the defendant at the beginning, I clearly agree it was inappropriate. But you have all these other circumstances that do exist, which don't exclude any of these other reasonable hypotheses of innocence, and also which don't provide evidence for the trial court to rely upon that what other way was I supposed to conclude
as
that?
As you see in some of these cases, they're able to pick up, you know, paint chips or, you know, whatever, or a dent or something, and then match it up, and we don't have that. Am I correct?
Yes, sir, and that was going to be the second part of that in terms of you would have expected that if this car, which they found, and they found a bumper of the car in the median, then they found his car later, and this bike, which they had, that there would have been some indication from a forensic standpoint that these two vehicles collided with one another. Paint, chips, damage, dents, something that would have indicated that there was contact between the two. And I think that it's not an unfair assumption or deduction or inference from the evidence that the police certainly would have looked for those things. I mean, they had the forensic teams out there.
Just a different question, just to clear it out of the way, that the trial court found that there was contact between the car and the motorcycle.
Correct.
If the trial court were to be wrong and simply that the motorcycle lost control at high rates of speed and hit the embankment, would there still be a sufficient basis from which the trial court could convict because he was being chased by the car, or is that pure speculation?
I think that's pure speculation because I think you would have needed more evidence to establish the defendant's conduct, his proximity to the motorcycle, the reaction of the motorcycle to the defendant's actions, how his car was positioned. There's a whole host of circumstances which aren't present in the record.
Now we get to the next point that I know you're going to get to, and that's the BAC that was excluded.
Correct. So the BAC, I mean, it would have been very simple for the court to say, okay, the BAC is admissible, and then just find it not to be relevant or the weight to attach to it. But he didn't do that. And I think what you'll see in the record is, I'm sure you've read very carefully, and this is found on page both 117 of the appendix as well as later 122 of the appendix, I think the judge just got confused. And I think what he was focused on is whether or not the Commonwealth could have introduced this BAC if it was a DUI prosecution. Because he's asking questions of, so it's not admissible from an inculpatory standpoint, but it would be admissible from an exculpatory standpoint. And he asks again, this is on page 122, but if the Commonwealth were trying to put it in for DUI prosecution or something of that nature, it clearly would not be admissible that way as I understand it. And I think he just got confused in looking at what the aspects of the admissibility were. It's clear that the BAC of the victim in this particular case is admissible. It's not. It was interesting you had a prior involuntary manslaughter with counsel.
And the juxtaposition, isn't it?
It's very interesting. And in the context of the involuntary manslaughter case is clearly the conduct of the victim the courts have found to be not relevant. But in this particular case, the conduct of the victim in the context of the BAC would be certainly relevant into how the accident happened in the again, in conjunction with the absence of evidence that we have as to any contact between the two parties and how the evidence itself actually occurred, the accident occurred. The cases that she cite, I think, are again, somewhat ironic in that the Rodriguez case, which is an unpublished decision from this court of 2009, in that particular case, the gentleman was operating a motorcycle, just like we have here. He was intoxicated, just like we had here. He had a blood alcohol content of 1.3, the same number we have here. And he suddenly and inexplicably slammed on his brakes locked up, and he hit the median. Sounds like our case. The other case also is an involuntary manslaughter Hall, again with a BAC of 1.3, and the court found that there is no contributory negligence in involuntary manslaughter. That's not the standard that we have here. With respect to Hubbard, which is also cited on page 875, I believe it is, of Hubbard, Hubbard says, only if the conduct of the deceased, in this case the motorcycle driver, amounts to an independent intervening act alone causing the fatal injury, can the accused, Mr. Miller, be exonerated from liability for his criminal negligence? And what's significant about that statement from the court is two things. Number one, the independent intervening act, the conduct of the victim, and then the defendant's own criminal negligence, which we don't have. We have no evidence before the court of the criminal negligence of the defendant in this particular case, but we do have evidence, if the BAC were admitted, of what could be an independent intervening act. And I'd be glad to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Brockman. Ms. Tyson?
May it please the court, with regard to the first issue of whether how this accident was caused and whether the evidence was sufficient to show that the cause, that the accident was caused by the defendant. In viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and bearing in mind that under the appropriate standard, whether a hypothesis of innocence is reasonable is a question of fact, which this court found in Wood, when we consider the evidence under those two pieces of the appellate standard of review, the evidence is sufficient, and I want to focus on seven different pieces of evidence that take us from basic facts to ultimate facts. The first one is the defendant's erratic driving upon even approaching the stoplight, before he was ever even had any contact with either of the motorcyclists. He was driving in an erratic fashion, took out a sign, a street sign, and came back onto the roadway. And Donaldson and Olney were at that stoplight. And I think that the record will reflect that Donaldson, of the two motorcyclists, is the one who said something vulgar.
He was mouthing off.
Yeah, he was the one who mouthed off. But both of the motorcyclists are there. And the response to Donaldson is also a response in the direction of Olney. So there's a rude verbal exchange at the traffic light. That's number two. Number three, the vehicles drive off. The motorcyclists proceed, and so does the defendant. And the defendant drives directly at Donaldson, and but for Donaldson's evasive action, he would have been hit because he was missed by inches. That was the testimony. Because he took evasive action, locked on his brakes, he was missed by inches. So after that, the defendant takes off after Olney, who's on his motorcycle.
Now, opposing counsel points out, what was his motive to go after the other guy who wasn't mouthing off?
Well, because they're motorcyclists together. They were both there at the light. They were both there together. It's not an unreasonable inference.
He's just mad at both
of them. He's mad at everybody. He's mad at the sign that he took out and the motorcyclist too. And it's true that there was testimony from Ms. Torres about a number of vehicles being there, but I believe that there's not testimony from Donaldson or even Ryder, and I can't put my finger on it right at this moment. I don't know that those people who were actually in the road were the ones saying that there were that many cars. Ms. Torres is at the drive-through window of a fast food restaurant. Amazingly, she's able to hear at least the exchange at the light, but she's not there as close to the action as the others. So shortly after the defendant accelerates towards Olney, Donaldson and Ryder see Olney and his bike separated on the ground. And number seven, after we've got the motorcycle and the victim on the ground, the defendant sped away from the scene, crashed into another vehicle totaling that automobile, and then fled in the opposite direction. So the trial court finds at pages 131 to 132 that there was really no other conclusion than that the motorcycle was struck by the defendant's car. That conclusion is supported by all of this circumstantial evidence. Was the trial judge plainly wrong in finding that? Was that finding without any evidentiary support? I think it's interesting in this case that the victim, Mr. Olney, has memory loss about what happened. He was not able, when he was questioned about some of his activity, said, after this accident, I have memory
about
problems.
I know you don't need forensic evidence in every case, but what about, I mean, it does seem odd that you wouldn't have a testimony or photographs or something to show, if the theory is contact. There's none of that.
There is none. No, there's no. Obviously, counsel is absolutely correct about that. But if it were necessary to have someone testify that there was a collision, then you'd never be able to prosecute one of these cases if no one else is on the road at all, or if the victim, if no one's on the road and the victim has memory loss, or if no one's on the road and the victim's dead, that you've got to somehow have somebody seeing the accident happen.
They have the bike, they have the car, and if the, as a trial judge concluded, there was a contact as opposed to a running off the road, then there, you would think of necessity there would be some physical evidence of that contact.
If there was physical evidence, that was not introduced into evidence. We don't have that in our record that I recall from my review of the record. And with regard to whether this was caused in some other manner, there was very little specific suggestions of how this might have been caused
in
trial. Yes.
Why is it reversible error for the trial judge to exclude the BAC?
Why is it reversible error?
Why is it not?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that the fact that the cases we relied upon were involuntary manslaughter cases mean that this court should not rely upon them as well. I understand this is an intentional crime.
The appellant argues that the trier of fact, being the judge who excluded the BAC, says that no, it's not relevant. But isn't it relevant if a cause of the accident, or is it not relevant that a cause of the accident could be his contributory able? I mean, how does it play in?
I don't believe that. I acknowledged in my brief that the cases that I was relying on were manslaughter cases and not intentional crime cases. But I don't believe that criminal negligence is a defense. And I will add to that, particularly in a case such as this, where there is no evidence that he was operating his motor vehicle in a way that indicated he had impairment from his any alcohol consumption. I will point out, because I think it's important, and maybe not directly responsive to your question, but I also think it's important, although there was a proffer stipulation that there was a 0.13, and I believe there was also a stipulation that the emergency workers smelled some alcohol, there was no proffer in this case, no expert or anybody else proffering what that 0.13 would be, what that would cause, why that would be a cause of the accident. And
well, if it was fleeing from somebody who was pursuing him, it would be, you know, the fact that he can't get away from somebody who's chasing him because he's drunk is hardly a defense.
And that's correct.
But counsel says, you know, it is relevant evidence that the trial court should have considered. Now, the trial court is the trial fact, but is it reversible error for him to have excluded the BAC, I guess, certificate?
It was not reversible error. At best, there was some possible relevance that could have.
It cannot be relevant. I mean, evidence is relevant if it sheds any. I mean, you don't have to move the ball by tens of yards. It can be inches, and that makes it relevant. And a 0.13, when no one saw the accident actually occur, allows the fact finder to either have reasonable doubt about what happened or to conclude that perhaps it was the intoxication and not the defendant that is to blame for the accident.
I think that would also be true in cases such as Hubbard and Rodriguez, the person who was intoxicated and couldn't hold on to the motorcycle, and yet this court and the Supreme Court found that unless this intoxication or other activity of the person who's injured is the sole cause, it doesn't come in. In Hubbard, the BAC was 0.18. It didn't come in. And I don't think that there is such a distinction between...
But there, what happened was fairly clear. Whereas here, in terms of, for example, the motorcyclist who vaulted the passenger into the ground, and I mean, there really wasn't any dispute as to what happened.
But I think there was in Hubbard. I think there was some question about which car was over the yellow line, and there was some factual dispute in that case. And the Supreme Court said, no, The .18 of the victim, there's no contributory negligence, and it's not coming in. And it seems that if it doesn't come in a case where there's where it's a criminal negligence kind of crime, it should not be admitted in a case such as this, where number one, it's an intentional crime, and number two, there's no evidence that
the
victim was impaired.
But what if the DAC was being used to show that it was the sole cause, that he was drunk, and the fact that he was being chased was irrelevant? I mean, we've got a fact finder. There is a BAC of the victim of 1-3. And is it relevant, or the trouble with bench trials, we don't know whether the trial judge considered it and rejected it or considered it and found it. We know he didn't find it of importance to the final striking of the vehicle. But my point, though I'm inartfully asking it, is so what? What is the importance of the .13 that would cause us to reverse this case because it was relevant to prove some point? What would that point be?
Well, obviously, it's our position that the court should not reverse based upon the court declining to admit or to consider the stipulated evidence, because, even if you reject the argument that under Hubbard and Rodriguez and Franklin Hall that it was not admissible, that in this case it would not be reversible error because there was no indication that this driver of the motorcycle was impaired in any way. I mean, the evidence before the court was that he and Donaldson got together at, I think it was a...
We exclude the .13, and then we say there was no evidence he was impaired.
I'm sorry?
It seems... Well.
But is your point that they were riding together for a long period of time,
and they certainly didn't drink
at the stoplight?
Correct. And in fact, Donaldson testified that he had nothing to drink while they were together, and they had been together. There was a telephone call at, I believe, 10:30. They got together at 11 o'clock. This was after midnight. They had been into a parking lot looking for someone. They did not have anything to drink during that period of time, as Donaldson testified.
Wouldn't we expect the friend, I'm sorry to interrupt, the friend to have some bias in favor of his buddy about...
Well, that certainly could have been explored at trial, whether he had some bias in favor of his friend. But I will say that
because the chief evidence with regard to the victim's control over his motorcycle was from his friend, who would be expected to support that he was not intoxicated and that he was driving correctly.
Well, And of course, there was testimony from a Mr. Ryder who didn't know either one of them, and it's not expansive on how well either motorcyclist was driving, but there was certainly no indication that they were
driving poorly. For that short span after the stop.
That's correct. And I realize that's a short period of time. And unfortunately for Mr. Olney, he doesn't have, according to his testimony, had no memory of what was happening on that night. And so he was not in a position to expound any more about his operation of the motorcycle.
What is your response to Mr. Broccoletti's point that the trial judge was in some way confused about the admissibility, the issue, the legal issue relating to the admissibility of the evidence?
Well, I don't know that the trial judge was confused. He did make reference to, would this blood alcohol content be admissible in a DUI prosecution? I don't know that simply comparing admissibility of a document in one case to another kind indicates some sort of confusion. The argument was made to him that we don't know how, by the defense, we don't know how this accident occurred, and so you need to let this evidence in, and the trial court said, no, it's not relevant. So it made a ruling, and I don't know that comparing it to another kind of case shows any kind of confusion.
Do you think the judge might have just been thinking out loud?
I think that certainly can happen. The time we normally deal with BAC documents is in a DUI case, and it's usually the Commonwealth that's trying to get them in. And so there was some discussion there. I just don't think that the record supports that the judge was confused, because he made a ruling that it was not relevant. I do want to make one quick point. I don't know that it's necessarily going to be important, but I don't think that there had to be a crash in order for the defendant to be guilty. We argued that on our brief. We cited the Long case for that because the statute says by any means cause bodily injury.
If the court found there was a crash, does that change?
It only does, Your Honor, if there was an additional need for evidence, which counsel has argued there was. I would suggest there's not under Right for the Wrong Reason, even under Perry. If the record is sufficient to support the alternative ground, this court does not reverse because there was another basis. Of course, under Bolden, this court can consider evidence that was not mentioned by either party or by the trial judge in making his determination. So I would urge this court to find that the evidence was sufficient and that the trial court did not err or did not commit reversible error with regard to the BAC document and affirm.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Tyson. Ms. Tyson, would you please return to the podium?
Just a real quick question.
Yes.
If this court were to find that the evidence was improperly admitted, is there a harmless error argument to be made by the Commonwealth?
Do you mean excluded?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Excluded.
Yes. Based on the evidence that's in the record before the court and the manner in which the motorcycle was being operated and the evidence of what happened. I don't want to go on too long, but just because no one saw the actual impact, no one saw the motorcycle go down at that moment, the circumstantial evidence is so strong that this defendant caused the motorcycle to go down and caused the injuries to the defendant. So yes, I would say that if there is error, that error would be harmless.
Thank you, Ms. Tyson. Mr. Broccoletti will also give you additional time.
I hope I don't need it. With respect to Hubbard, and the court, I'm sure, has read this and will read this. In Hubbard, the argument was that the consumption of alcohol by the decedent impaired her ability to take evasive action by turning off the road to the right. That's not the argument here. The argument is not that the alcohol consumption impaired the ability. The argument is that the alcohol consumption caused the accident, and he individually was responsible for the action.
Or at least injects reasonable doubt as
Correct.
To the cause.
Correct.
I mean, you don't have to prove, I mean, it's great if you can prove it, but all you need is reasonable doubt.
The rare circumstance when I can prove it. So, but the other aspect of it is that the fact that Mr. Olney had traveled a period of time and over a distance in an appropriate manner in no way matters to the conduct of the impairment or the decision as to whether he was impaired. This court's heard many cases in which a police officer has followed an individual for a half a mile or mile. He's abided all traffic violations, traffic signals, done the correct speed, and then all of a sudden switches lanes, hits a median, does something. It happens in a moment in time. And so the fact that there was no evidence of impairment before in the driving does not exclude the fact that there was evidence of impairment at the time. To answer Judge Decker's question, I'd suggest no, it's not harmless error in any way, shape, or form to exclude this particular evidence when it's relevant to the causation of what the accident is.
Mr. Broccoli, can you answer one other question?
Yes, ma'am.
How do you respond to the, the procedural default argument?
With respect to
by the Commonwealth
on the malice issue,
with regard to the malice and the evidence, yeah.
I'd submit that to the court.
Okay,
that's why I focused on arguments 1 and 3.
Got it. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you very much,
Mr.
Broccoletti and Ms. Tyson. We're going to come down and greet counsel, and then we'll adjourn for the day.